The following message is brought to you by Cashin First Baptist Church in Cashin, Oklahoma. For more information about our church, please visit cashinfbc.org.
Well, good morning. I am excited to be here. Let me give you greetings from your Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma, now called the Oklahoma Baptist Convention, and work with BCM, Baptist Collegiate Ministry. How many people have ever heard of BCM? How many people have ever heard of BSU? You just told your age. All right, yeah. So it was BSU when I was in college. It was BCM 9 years ago when I took over this job. I first came to convention. I was a youth pastor for 18 years and then came to convention as a youth evangelism specialist. And then after that, about in 2013, they asked me to step in and start doing BCM, which, by the way, I didn't know anything about. I went one time when I was at OSU and never went back. And so when they asked me about doing the job, I said, it probably should be somebody who went, you know. But this is what God had for me. I understand it now. And it's a phenomenal ministry. Incredible things. And by the way, on 39 campuses in Oklahoma, every time you give something in your offering plate, a portion of that money goes to support the BCM ministries on our campus. We have 39 campuses across Oklahoma that have a ministry on them. And it is phenomenal. It is one of the things that COVID has not been able to shut down. We are seeing students come to know Christ. We're seeing... Now, our guys are sharp, but they've been very good. Our leaders have been very sharp about, hey, we have to do things a little bit differently, but we're seeing greater numbers than we've ever seen. We're seeing more salvations than we've seen in a while because there's just, God is doing some incredible things and there's a hunger there. And so I'm excited to tell you about that. And in case you're wondering, it wasn't on the sports last night. Yes, Friday and Saturday was the BCM basketball tournament in Shawnee, and Carl Albert, girls won first place in the women's section, and... OSU beat Tulsa University in the finals for the men's section. It was exciting, and now you know. Not that you care, but now you know. Listen, I'm excited to be here to get to speak. Now, Denise and I, this is my wife, Denise, and we've actually been coming here since August. We moved to Cashin last August. If you've not met me, it's because we sit on the back row, and I was raised in Baptist church, and that's what you do. So if I'm not speaking, that's where I'm. In fact, three times... since August, they've had to bring in extra chairs just to make a back row for me because we got here late and it was already full. And so we're excited to be here. Man, I absolutely love the church and love getting to... I've known Greg for years, never really got to hear him speak, and phenomenal speaker, isn't he? I need to apologize to you, though. I made a mistake. I told people that for like the first 3 or 4 weeks. I was, man, this is incredible. Man, Greg does a great job. And then I remembered, that's how... pastors end up leaving and going somewhere else. Denise mentioned, she said, I hope he doesn't ever leave. So I've been telling people he's terrible. I want him to be here. In fact, if you hear a rumor of drug abuse, I started it. All right. So I don't want that guy to leave. We're excited about being here and being part of the church, being part of the community. I am part of the community. I've gone to the gym a couple of times. And to a wrestling duel. So that's it. That's home, right? All right. If you want to open your Bibles, we're going to look at John 4. We're actually going to start there. We're going to look at several. And we're going to look at about three stories quickly this morning. And they come from a passage I read years ago and just thought, man, that's incredible. I know if you have any kind of pet, any kind of animal, at some time they've gotten out. And you've gone on that search looking for them. I've looked for dogs. I've looked for cats. A couple weeks ago, I have some cows now, and I learned that if you don't shut the gate, they decide not to stay around. And so at 5:15 in the morning, I was driving dirt roads looking for 20 cows that had decided they didn't like my place anymore. And there's that panic, that anxiety, but there's kind of a bit of an excitement when you actually realize, there they are, I found them, and you get to take them home. There's a passage in Matthew, let me just read it to you. It says, what do you think? If a man owns 100 sheep and one of them wanders away, will he not leave the 99 on the hills and go look for that one that wandered off? And if he finds it, I tell you the truth, he is happier about that one sheep than about the 99 that did not wander off. In the same way, our Father in heaven is not willing that any of these little ones should be lost. I read that passage one day and I thought, I wonder what it looks like when Jesus goes looking for the sheep. I know what it looks like when I go looking for it. I thought, when Jesus goes looking for the lost sheep, what does that look like? Someone look at it. We'll see it all through the New Testament. Let's focus on three stories this morning. The first one is in John 4. And you know the story well. We'll read a little bit and talk about it a little bit. It says, the Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining, in verse 1, the Pharisees heard that Jesus was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, which bothered them, by the way. Although, in fact, it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. When the Lord learned of this, he left Judea, went back once more to Galilee. Now, he had to go through Samaria. Some people will say he didn't have to go. That the language say he chose to take the path that went through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about the sixth hour. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy some food. But the Samaritan woman said to him, "You're a Jew and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Now, this story we know pretty well, but if we look back on actually the culture that was happening at that time, it really, really comes alive with several things. Let me tell you a couple things about that. One was Jews did not talk to Samaritans at all. There was a 400-year deep-rooted racial hatred between the two groups. Jews despised Samaritans. Samaritans despised Jews. They hated each other. There was a guy not too long ago, Dwight Pryor had a thing called the Center for Judeo-Christian Studies, and he talked about in worship gatherings like this, when Jewish men would come together and the women would sit at the back, the men would be up at the front, they'd end the still. There were actually times where we have worship, we have the offering. They would have a time where men could get up and talk trash on Samaritans, basically, and talk about how great it would be when God would clear them off the face of the earth, get rid of the dogs and the Gentiles and the Samaritans, and life would be like it was supposed to, like it was intended to be, only Jews. Then they would continue with their worship. It was a great deal. It's the kind of thing we do, like, outside, but they did it actually as part of their worship. And so they hated each other, despised each other. And then Jewish men, now I'm the deliverer here. I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I'm saying this is culture. Jewish men saw themselves as far above worth over Jewish women. So they would not, now depending on which scholar you read, either they would not talk to any woman in public, or they would only speak to a family member who was a female in public. But they wouldn't talk to women, never, never in public. They just didn't, it just wasn't done. And then a rabbi, which Jesus was obviously known as a rabbi was very careful about their reputation. I mean, the rabbis, the Pharisees, they were very, very careful about who they talked to. You had to be pretty much upper echelon in the religious world to talk, for them to actually speak to you or acknowledge you when they walked by. So here we have a story where Jesus walks into a town he could have avoided because there was another route he could have taken. But he walks into a town that he could have avoided, but full of Samaritans, full of Samaritans. And then a lady comes, a Samaritan woman comes to a well, who, by the way, you know the story well, didn't have a very good reputation, and Jesus knew it, didn't he? Because he calls her on a little bit later. He says, "No, in fact, man, you've had six husbands, but man you're living with now isn't your husband." And so he knows this woman. He knows the situation, and yet he speaks to her. Now, to you and I, that would not be a big deal. To this world, that was huge. Jesus speaks to a Samaritan woman. And they have a conversation. And when it gets too personal, then she turns it to religious. She says, "Well, I know you guys worship over here. Our fathers say worship over here. We'll figure it all out later." And it's after that Jesus gets really personal. And it so impacts her life. And he talks to her about the living water. He said, "I can give you living water. I can do something that will change your life forever." And God, the Spirit of God touches her and changes her. And she becomes so excited. What does she do? She runs back to town. I used to think she ran to town and grabbed her friends. But the scripture tells us she grabbed the town. Okay? She's like a crazy lady running around saying, "Hurry, come on, come on. You've got to come to the well with me. You have to see this man who knew everything about me. Could this be the Messiah?" You see, the Samaritans had been waiting on a Messiah as long as the Jews had. They were very similar. And so they're saying, "But could this be the guy we've heard about? Could this be?" And she was so compelling that the entire town evidently left what they were doing, went to the well, and began to hear Jesus. And they were so impacted, it was so impacted, that encounter, that they said, "Would you stay with us?" And so they did for about 3 days. And he just taught. And he taught them scripture. And he had meals with them. And at the end of 3 days, they said, "You know, we came to hear you at first because the crazy woman told us we needed to. But now we've heard you and we believe because we've heard you for ourselves." An entire town was changed. Now, here's what impressed me about that story so much was Jesus should have never done that. if he were going to follow the religious rules of his day, not the biblical rules, not God's law, not God's heart, but the religious rules of his day, he would have never even spoken to the woman. He would have looked down on her. He might have talked about her later. But instead, he had this encounter that not only changed a woman's life, it changed an entire city. Because he was willing to stick his neck out and say, do something different, and say, no, this is what I came for. This is what I didn't come to make people who feel good about themselves feel better about themselves. I came to touch lives and to change lives. You know what I think is also powerful and impactful here? He didn't have a list of things she needed to do before he could change her life. He didn't say, I'll tell you what, I got six things. If you will go back, you need to leave, you need to do that. If you will become a moral person, then you can come to me. He said, I've got something that can change your life. Come on, do it now. It so impacted me, I thought, it challenged me. Because I thought, would I have done that? Or would I have fallen back into my judgmental side to say, well, and come up with all the reasons why it was okay not to talk to her. So if Jesus had done what good Jewish men were supposed to do, what good Jewish religious people, that encounter, those lives would have never been changed. Turn over to Matthew 8 for me. Matthew 8, so the first story is a woman who really was a social outcast, I believe, because of choices she had made. And yet Jesus immediately said, I've got something for you. In Matthew 8, it starts and it says, when he came down from the mountainside. Now, does anyone remember what Matthew 5, 6, and 7 is? It's when he went up on the mountainside. Yeah. It said, Matthew 5 says, now, when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountainside. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, and then we have the whole Sermon on the Mount. Many people say, well, there could be a series of smaller sermons, but most scholars would tell you it was a big day at church. It was kind of a long sermon, okay? And so that's what's happening now. Here's what I think. I say that because I found this to be interesting. It says, when he came down from the mountainside, large crowds followed him. They just had a pretty long extended service. Pretty big time at church. Now, Joe, I'll pick on you. As mesmerizing as this sermon is going to be, and obviously already is, when we get done, you're going to chat for a little bit, and then what are you going to do?
Go home.
How many people are going to go to lunch? How many people are thinking about lunch? Yeah, we have our routines, we have our things. This is what impressed me about this, because at the end of a long, long, long sermon, people could not get enough of Jesus. And so as he came down to leave, he was surrounded by a large, large group of people. I believe in so much because this is a culture that had grown up. If you're here in Sunday school, they talked about this. They grew up in a rules-oriented society. There's 613 written laws by God in the Old Testament. But there were thousands of man-made laws that said, well, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. You know, one of the man-made laws was you can't spit in the dirt on the Sabbath because water and dirt make mud. That's how bricks are made. It might be interpreted you were trying to make a tiny brick. As ridiculous as it is, there were thousands of those laws, and that's what the Pharisees were so, so adamant about. By the way, it's a whole other sermon, but you remember when Jesus spit in the dirt, made mud, and put it on a man's eyes who'd been blind from birth, and a miracle happened that had never been seen before? I've heard people say, well, he did that so he could show he could use anyway. No, if you look at that passage, it says, and it was on the Sabbath. Jesus said, your silly man-made rules are not why we're here. God, this is about God. And so a large crowd has followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Now, a lot happened in that sentence right there. Leprosy was the only thing I can really relate it to is in the early 80s when AIDS really exploded in our world. We didn't know how you caught it. We knew it was deadly. We knew it was dangerous. We knew it was horrible. You didn't want to get it. And so there was a huge, huge fear of AIDS. That was leprosy in their day because it was contagious, it was around, and when you got it, it was devastating. It could be devastating to you, it could be devastating to your family. In fact, in Leviticus 13, it gave them the rules for leprosy. It said, the person inflicted with an infectious disease is to have his clothes torn, his hair hanging loose. He must cover his mouth and cry out, unclean, unclean. He will remain unclean as long as he has the infection. He must live alone in a place outside the camp. So the story was, basically, if there was a spot on you, you would take it to the priest. The priest then would declare this is either infectious disease or not. If he said, yes, infectious, then immediately, you didn't go home and pack a bag, immediately you tore your clothes, you messed your hair up. Basically, what you did was you made sure that if anybody saw you, you stepped outside the synagogue or outside that area, and a friend of yours saw you, they knew something was wrong. They wouldn't approach you. They wouldn't get close to you. And then on top of that, the humiliating part of, I'm sick, I'm unclean, stay away from me, stay away from me, as you walked out of town, away from your family, away from your life, to live in a place either with other lepers or to establish a place outside of town that you could live by yourself. Your family was able to come out, bring you food, not to you, drop the food off, you could pick it up. It was a horrible, horrible life to live, horrible way to live. And they were not allowed to be, couldn't come in town, couldn't be around people. Think about that. A large crowd follows Jesus down. A leper walks through the middle of that crowd, not supposed to be there. I cannot find the penalty for a leper coming back to town. I've looked, I've tried to find it. But I've seen in that day and time, people stoned for a lot less. And I just, my mind's eye, I just imagine as that leper walks toward Jesus, that crowd begins to part. And men, fathers, who watch this guy putting their family in danger, begin to pick up stones. At a minimum, they shudder away. They just part the waters. He comes and he falls down in front of Jesus. I think he knew what was happening. I think he knew he was risking his life to walk in that crowd, to violate all the laws, and to come down in front of Jesus. And I began to think, what was it about Jesus' reputation that made him willing to say, it's worth it. Either I'll die in the next 60 seconds or this man can save me. Here's what really bothered me about that. I wondered if that's the reputation of our church, our churches, of Christians in the United States. I think, is that when people are so desperate? Are we the people that they think about immediately and say, if I can get to them, I know they can take care of me? Or are we that crowd that parts the ways and figures out all the reasons why what this person is doing shouldn't be doing? So interesting thing happens. Jesus reached out. He said, Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean. Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. I am willing. Now, this is an incredibly theological, diverse passage right here, because Jesus was not allowed to touch. As a rabbi, he couldn't touch a diseased person or he would become spiritually unclean. And so there's a great debate over whether Jesus healed him before he touched him or after he touched him, and it doesn't matter. Because the thing is, he touched him. I remember seeing, and we moved to Tulsa. We were youth pastors in Tulsa for about 11 years. And there was a special on one of those documentary things, you know, investigative type things. It was on AIDS. And they were actually in a ward where AIDS patients were being treated. But they were not being treated to get well because there were no cure at that time. They had offered themselves up to be studied in hopes that their sacrifice would help people down the road. They were there to die. And so the guys and all the people that were interviewing, everyone except the patients were in hazmat suits. I mean, fully decked out. And I remember they were asking different questions, interviewing. They were interviewing one man, and he, as he was interviewing him, he was cut on the side. The interviewer put his hand on his shoulder and the microphone to his mouth. And the young man began to weep. I'm not talking like tear up. I'm talking uncontrollably sob. Enough that you could tell they stopped the interview, gave him time to recover himself, and started it back. But, of course, the question was, what just happened? What was it about this encounter, your memories, or you think of past? What was it that made this such an emotional reaction? And the man said this, young man, he said, I am so sorry. I'm so embarrassed. I said, it's not me. He said, when you touched me, he said, it's been so long since anyone touched me that wasn't taking blood or doing something medical. He said, I forgot how good it feels to have another human being touch you. I just remember thinking, this is the United States of America. There are churches everywhere. how could it be that a person or a group of people could ever be in a situation where that kind of touch was withheld from them because of something that was wrong with them? I think Jesus reached out and touched this man for a couple of reasons. Number one, to tell the crowd, he's okay. Number two, to tell the guy, you're worth it. You're okay. Jesus reached out, touched the man. Immediately, it says he was cured of his leprosy. But go and show yourself to the priest, Jesus said, and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. This is one of those situations where a man was an outcast, social outcast, absolutely cut off from everyone else, looked down upon. There were some Jewish people who would have said, well, this is because of the sin in his life. He's getting what he deserves. Those legalistic people who always want to say, who always feel they're better than everyone else, they would have looked and said, this man is just getting what he deserves. But the truth is, Jesus approached a man who is a social outcast because of nothing on his own, of his own fault, and embraced him. And I think that's what it looks like when Jesus goes out and looks for the lost sheep. Let's look at one more. Turn over to Matthew 9. We actually looked at this a couple of weeks ago, and Pastor Greg did a great job of working through this story. You'll find it in a couple of different Gospels. Matthew 9, verses 10, it says, while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners. Now, the word sinner there can be used in two different things. It can be used to describe people who weren't as holy as the Pharisees. And it can also be used to describe people that were just bad news, okay? In this particular case, it's people who are just bad news, okay? And so this is who Jesus is having dinner with. They came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked the disciples. Now, I do think this is interesting. Jesus is sitting there, but they begin to whisper to the disciples. Why? Greg talked to us several weeks ago and continually talks about how the Pharisees were those people who, they were self-proclaimed righteous people. It wasn't like they were elected by the church. They decided they would become a Pharisee, and so many of them just began to take on the Pharisee rules. They wouldn't eat and clean. They wouldn't go to lunch with us because the food wouldn't have been washed the right way. Hands might not have been washed. They might have accidentally contaminated themselves without knowing it and then lose a little bit of their religious rank, okay? And so this is the people that are constantly, constantly trying to find fault with Jesus. And I think if you've attacked the man a couple times and he's slammed you, which Jesus did constantly, then what do? You start murmuring to his friends, to his followers. Because if you can divide the followers away from the leader, then you can now say, well, see, we can break this thing up. So they began to whisper to the disciples. They asked the disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? They're saying, you shouldn't do that. If you're a rabbi, you should know better than that. You also shouldn't sit with women of ill repute and ask them for a drink of water. On hearing this, Jesus said, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have not come to call the righteous, but I've come to call sinners. Jesus walked into a group of people who absolutely needed to hear the good news of Jesus. By the way, I have preached this before and later heard that some of the students in the youth group said, see, Mom, that's why I should go to parties. No. No question. Jesus never once questioned who he was, what he was here to do. He was also 30 when he went to this party, okay? Just throwing that out there. Jesus constantly went to the people that needed to hear the good news, that needed the gospel. He didn't go to call moral people to be more moral. He came to find lost people like you and me who desperately needed to hear the good news of Jesus, and he talked to them about it. I have always wondered, we talk about the Holy Spirit walks with us and those things. I've wondered what it would be like if Jesus and I hung out for a day, 24 hours. Because I'd want to take him, I'd want him to meet all my friends, I'd want him to meet, go see where I work, you know, and honestly, I'd want him to be telling me what a great job I did and how proud he was of me. But here's what I feel like would probably happen. I feel like probably a dozen times in 24 hours, we'd be going somewhere and I'd be on my way toward my next mission, and I'd look around and he'd be gone. I'd be, I lost Jesus again. And I'd have to go backtrack and find him. And I feel like I would find him with one of these groups. I'd find him sitting and talking to someone that I just didn't, maybe I didn't even notice him. Or worse, maybe I did, and I didn't care. Maybe I noticed him, and I just felt like I was better than them. Maybe I noticed him, and I thought, well, they're too far gone for Jesus. Maybe I noticed him, and I thought, well, if they'd clean their act up a little bit, I think I'd invite them to go to church. Then they could hear the gospel. And I think all day long, I would just constantly be trying to drag Jesus away from people that I should have sat down and talked with. Would you bow your heads with me for just a moment? I want to say a couple things before we sing a closing song. And I just ask you to bow your heads just so we can focus on ourselves. Maybe this morning that you come to church, maybe you've been coming for a while, you've never really felt good enough. You thought, well, if I can, one day when I can stop doing this or get rid of that and be a little bit better, then I'll go to Jesus. Can I tell you right now, you're exactly who Jesus wants. Jesus has everything to change your life right now, and you don't need to change a thing other than you need to be willing to step out and say, Jesus, I want you to take over my life. And there are so many men and women in this church, in this congregation, that could this morning after we get done, could sit down and open the scriptures and say, let me show you how that happens. You just need to be bold enough to ask somebody. For the rest of us, this can be a condemning type service or a celebration. And I look more towards the celebration. I think when we look at this passage, we see Jesus doing incredible things that we really want to do in our heart. Maybe we're not brave enough. Maybe we haven't thought about it. But this week, my prayer is that as we look and see people, that we will see them the way God sees them, listen to them the way God listens to them, hear what they say, and that we'll be able to make them more important than ourselves, and we'll take time to sit down and talk to the woman at the well, to put our arm around and hug the outcast because of something that's happened to him.